danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 213 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I am Nate Mavis, and with me from Owings Mills, Maryland, is Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
I'm doing pretty good. So I think I mentioned on the last episode of the show that the World Poker Tour Deep Stacks is having a series at Maryland Live, and I ended up taking second in one of the preliminary events, so it was pretty exciting. Unfortunately, I did not cash the main event. I made day two, but busted pretty quickly on day two, but that was still enough to turn it into a nice little series, taking second in a $500 event.
Yeah, congratulations. Congratulations. I'm feeling a little sheepish right now because I intended to congratulate you, then I just forgot over the last few days, and we just had this conversation before we got on air, and we talked about all sorts of poker things, and at no point during that conversation did I congratulate you for a very nice tournament finish. So, Andrew, thanks. Congratulations on a very nice tournament finish.
Thank you. And, you know, these live tournaments, it's so much more exciting than an online tournament to kind of get down to it. I really have only made a handful of live final tables, so that was pretty pretty exciting experience.
Yeah, it's really great, and any schmuck can win one, and
but taking second, that's special.
Taking second and you know, taking second and not shopping, that takes moxie. So nice job.
Thank you. And then I'm also looking forward. I'm likely to be in Pittsburgh this weekend, and I have not played at the Rivers Casino there since I lived in Pittsburgh it's been, I think, more than 2 years now since I lived there. So it should be fun to return to my old stomping grounds. And then weekend after that, there's a WSOP circuit event at the Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore, which I went there the opening weekend of it, and I liked the facility, but I just don't think there's really a lot of action going on there. They don't really have big games, I think. So I haven't been back since opening weekend, which was a couple of years ago. So I'm looking forward to having an excuse to go back there, because I do remember liking the room and liking the casino. And then Spring Championship of Online Poker is upon us. So and then WSOP, of course. So lots of poker coming up in my future.
Yeah. Very exciting. And a lot of poker. No. A lot of poker coming up in my future, too. It's just that my poker is sweating you, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm having podcast nostalgia these days because, you know, back in the early days of the show, you would be talking about what you were doing at Rivers just all the time. And a lot of our early material came from the Rivers. And also early in the show, I talked about how I just finished defending my dissertation proposal, and now I've defended my dissertation. So it feels like a big part of my life that has been sort of entirely comprehended by the podcast. So that's
Speaking of WIFT, congratulations. That's a big deal. Congratulations on that.
Oh yeah, you congratulated me over email. Thanks. It was it was a thing. Drove to Ithaca, defended the dissertation, drove back. Stopped in Cooperstown. I don't know. It was good.
Now, what exactly goes into defending a dissertation? I mean, is this mostly a formality? Is there a real chance that you're like, is something truly at stake here?
Well, plenty is at stake. It depends a lot on which university you're in, which department of which university you're in, and other cultural factors. As it happens, the philosophy department at Cornell tries not to encourage you to schedule a defense if they think you're not prepared for it. So the idea is, like, everybody wants you to succeed. Like, you want to succeed, they want you to succeed, the university wants you to succeed, everybody involved wants you to pass. That said, it is, like, a real thing, and you do, in fact, have to pass. So, that's, and I don't know, it's your committee, and you go and you sit in a room and they ask you questions. Sometimes there are external people there, sometimes not. And, I don't know, mine lasted a bit over 2 hours, and yeah, talked about Plato for a while.
How much of a sense do you have in advance of what the questions are likely to be? I mean, do they deliberately try to throw you curveballs?
No. Although generally, so I mean, I'm an eighth year grad student now, right? Because I've been working while also being a grad student. So my committee knows me pretty well, and I know them pretty well, and they've sent me a bunch of comments on stuff. So I know basically what sorts of stuff they're curious about and where they think like the weakest points of my arguments are. So it would be silly not to expect some questions about that. But you know, then there are always new drafts. So I sent them the last draft and they agreed to examine me on it. And then they read it and asked me questions about it. So there was a mix of stuff I was expecting and stuff that I was not expecting. I wouldn't say they were trying to throw me curveballs. So, like, I think in a lot of mathematics defenses, like, they want to test how truly comprehensive your knowledge of, like, all of math is. So they'll, you know, really try to probe you and really, you know, really examine you. In this case, it was more about examining the work, I think. And it was less about, like, am I, Nate Mavis, a philosophical genius? And more, like, is my dissertation defensible?
So are you officially Dr. Mavis now? Are there any further T's to cross and I's to dot?
Many T's to dot, cross and I's to dot. Cornell is not derided as the big red tape for nothing. There's some sort of ceremony that I will not be attending in late May. So I believe on May 28th, I think that is the day when I become a doctor.
Nice.
Or as we say at work, a doctor who doesn't help people. Yeah, and some forms to submit and some fees to pay between now and then. So,
yeah. Nice. Well, congratulations on making it thanks. Far. I imagine that at least the 99% of the hardest is behind you.
Oh, yeah. It's more than 99%. Thank you very much. It feels good. It's big part of my life, and like I've been on an academic calendar in some sense, like, you know, since I was in pre-K or something, like for well over 90% of my life. So it's really interesting. In a month I will no longer be a student enrolled anywhere, except like possibly, you know, depending if you count Coursera or whatever. it's in some sense a big life change. In a lot of other senses, not so much. But that's that.
It's almost time for the Spring Championship of Online Poker, and then the World Series of Poker will be upon us. And of course, even if you are not playing the WSOP, there will be tournament series going on all over Las Vegas this summer, and probably all over the world. That means it's time to get your tournament game in tip-top shape, which means it's time for Tournament Poker Edge. Tournament Poker Edge offers everything from theory videos to hand history reviews to live sweats across a variety of stakes and in a variety of tournament formats. You're sure to plug some leaks and learn some new tricks to try out at the tables this summer. So what are you waiting for? Sign up today at tournamentpokeredge.com. Perhaps ambitiously, I pulled together three strategy hands for us to discuss today, and just to make sure that we get to the most important first. We'll start with mine.
Yeah. We're what, like 6-1 dogs to get to all three strategy hands in a reasonable amount of time? I don't think that's going to happen.
I will say, I think that the third one is relatively short. It's just a preflop question.
All right. 3-1.
So this is from the $570 preliminary event, LOL Rakements, at Maryland Live. We are down to 20 players remaining, with 18 to be paid. Blinds are 1,500, 3,000. I am starting with a stack of a little over like 210K, about 70 big blinds. There's one player at the table who covers me, and then I think the majority of the table is more in like the 30 to 40 big blind neighborhood. I'm under the gun. We're seven-handed right now. I'm under the gun with 10-8 of clubs, and I open. I think that this is, from this position, like, at a table full of really tough players trying hard, probably a fold. I think on the bubble with a number of players who are more interested in cashing and or just don't really have the fundamentals to push as hard as they potentially could. I think this is a hand I certainly want to be opening. And I am using a min-raising strategy right now, again, because I think a lot of people are just kind of under-defending, which, again, means that I can squeeze a few more hands into my opening range. Any objection to my raising this?
No, not at all. I think I'll say what I usually say, which is that it depends not only how well they're playing, but precisely how they're playing. Like, if they're playing badly in a way that involves three betting a lot, then you still can't open this. but
at this stage of the tournament, I think people are too tight.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you do have a playable hand. Seven-handed as opposed to nine-handed makes a very big difference. I would open this given what you've described. I also think your raise size is good. Against most of the table, 6,000 and 7,500 or whatever the relevant alternative is will get roughly the same number of folds. This is a play that mostly involves fold equity. Where it will make a big difference is with the big blind. Well, some people it won't make a difference. They're not sensitive to bet sizing, but you will get some more calls from the big blind, and that's where it becomes again relevant that you have 10-8 suited. It's a very floppable hand. You'll just flop a lot of draws, and it's a hand you want to take in position. So I think it's a great situation. And I think that the only thing wrong with the raise size is that you invite the big blind in a little bit more, but that's okay. It's a lot better than giving yourself a worse price by making it bigger, all things considered here.
Right, and I'm fine with, as you said, with the big blind coming in. I mean, I'd certainly prefer the extra. I would like to have the extra fold equity, but this is a hand that'll play perfectly well against his calling. It's like, I'll just take whatever my equity plus position value is and work from there.
Yep.
So I went to 12K from under the gun, seven-handed again, holding 10-8 of clubs. And the only player at the table who has me covered, he's in the hijack. He's also the best of my opponents at the table. I would guess probably like a 24 to 26-year-old, live pro sort of guy. So I think that I'm like, I don't want to sound too arrogant. I think I'm solidly better than he is, but he's solidly better than the rest of the table is. He 3-bets to a little over 12K. He later told me that this was a misclick and he meant to make it 17K. I think that's pretty plausible. He just failed to grab as many 5K chips as he meant to. That said, I mean, there are people who actually will just have a very small 3-betting range here because they don't like to cold call, and so they just do a very like depolarized 3-bet everything they're going to play kind of strategy. Mm-hmm. So I considered both of those possibilities in game. I think with the price that I'm getting and the fact that he's going to be 3-betting hands that aren't aces and kings, I think this is just a very clear call. I'm just getting, so it folds back to me, and I'm just getting like an extremely good price to call.
Poker 101, think about your pot odds. You're getting very good pot odds. Put the money in. I would fold to the 17K.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah, good.
And even though, I mean, he's certainly capable of doing this light, and this is a good time for him to do it light, he also has like a ton of hands that dominate me in his range, and it's going to be hard for me to play even on 10 or 8 high flops. And with a worse price, this is a fold.
It's good to do light because you have to fold hands like 10-8 suited.
We go to the flop with 34K in the pot. It is King of Spades, 9 of Hearts, 7 of Hearts, and I am holding 10-8 of Clubs. Effective stacks are a little under 200K at this point, 34K in the pot, so effective stack is something like 6x pot, maybe a little less than that. So I've got an open-ended straight draw. I check, which I think I'm just doing 100% of the time on this flop. He bets 15K into 34K, and I chose to raise to 45. I don't think this is automatic because this is not a flop where I think I get to do a tremendous amount of check raising in theory. I think, though, that this is, I think even if I'm doing only a kind of minimal equilibrium sort of amount of check raising, this is probably a hand that goes in a check raising range sometimes, just because it's sort of a, it's a good draw. It's a kind of a hidden draw, in that you do want to have some check raises on this board that are not just two hearts, so that you can have bluffs when the turn card is a heart. You know, if your check raising range here just consists of like two pair plus and heart draws, then your range is inordinately strong when a four of hearts comes. So for board coverage purposes, I want to be check raising some hands that are not two hearts, and this is sort of the best non-flush draw hand that I might have. I also think that this is a spot where a lot of people will continuation bet too often, or with a kind of unprotected range. So there's a lot of hands that don't really play great as a bet on this flop that he could have, like pocket queens, or maybe not a lot, but I think there's hands like pocket queens and pocket jacks. Maybe even if he three bet a hand like king jack or something, he might choose not to continuation bet that. I think that there are some hands that he may well want to check on this flop. And then depending on how light he is, I think he's going to have a fair number of hands that are going to have trouble when faced with a check raise. Ace queen and ace jack come to mind immediately. He might also have some gut shotty kinds of hands like a queen jack suited or a jack 10, or I guess jack 10 double gutted. So that's probably not folding, but I think I'm risking only about the size of the pot. I have a lot of equity when called, and I think he is likely to have a robust bet folding range, possibly even an overly wide bet folding range. That's my reasoning for check raising here.
It's funny. It's spoiler alert. It is very, 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 very relevant that Jack 10 is double gutted. Do not forget that fact. Yeah, I like the raise. I think it's a good hand to raise. I'm not sure what goes on in equilibrium. I do know that nines and sevens, those are sets that you have all of, and he has possibly none of. So that's really good. And even if he doesn't believe you, you can represent a lot of hands later. He should have some really good value hands like aces, ace king, the occasional top set, hands like that. He'll also have some hands that shove it in your face, like the nut flush draw, or even like if he had jack 10 of hearts. I mean, he could have a combo draw, then that will shove it in your face, probably. But even a worse draw, he could decide to put you to the test with. But I think this is a good spot to have some raises. I think this is a good hand to raise with. And also, like, it's a good raise if he's a really, really good player. Let's say he's not quite as good as you suspect he is. Is he going to be folding too much or not enough? The answer is too much. So I think sort of averaging over all the player types he could be, because you know him pretty well, but not perfectly well, the raise gets even better.
Yeah, that's kind of how I'm thinking about it, is like worst case scenario, it's probably like break even-ish relative to calling. And I think it only gets better from there as he plays less well.
Yep.
So we go to the turn, he calls the raise. We go to the turn with 124K in the pot and 165 remaining in the effective stack. So this is like 1.25-ish pot, stack to pot ratio at this point. And the turn is the four of hearts. So I'm holding 10-8 of clubs. And recall, a big part of my reason for wanting to check raise this hand on the flop is that I think my range is very strong on a heart turn. I think my check raising range on the flop mostly consists of heart draws and maybe sets and two pairs. So when the four of hearts comes on the turn, a 10-8 of clubs is, I would say, just kind of a mandatory bluffing hand. It is possible for me to put a lot of money in now drawing dead if my opponent flatted with a flush draw on the flop. You know, Nate, you raised the possibility that he might jam the flop with flush draws. I wouldn't be surprised if he's doing, you know, some three betting and some calling depending on the flush draw. So, you know, there is a possibility that I'm drawing dead here, but we can't focus too much on that. Overall, I think I'm going to have a very strong range here. I think my opponent still has a lot of hands in his range, like Nate, you mentioned ace king and pocket aces. You know, there may be weaker kings in there as well. He has a ton of hands like that are not going to be happy to see, you know, another 165K go into the pot. Mm-hmm. So I really want to be putting pressure on those hands. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's good. I have a couple questions for you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if now is the right time to do it.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, do you think he could have ace 9 and ace 7 suited? I mean, I think he could, at least sometimes. He bets the flop, but then he sees you raise and he says, wait a minute, there are a lot of draws up there. I have position. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get bluffed. I call. Yeah. I mean, I think that's at least some of his range. Mm-hmm. Also, like, did he seem to consider three betting the flop?
I don't recall having that impression.
Okay. Oh, that's really good then. That makes the bet a lot better. Like, it's yeah, a rare player. More, like, I mean, sets out of us. Yeah, I mean, like, well, sets and oh, flush draws. And flush draws. That flush draws. I mean, it's a rare player. It's a really rare player, even a good one, or a better than the rest of the table one, who will have ace jack of hearts here and get raised on the flop and not sort of jump a little bit and not and also not think about jamming. And I think, in fact, a lot of people will, for a bunch of very good reasons, shove that hand in your face. And he didn't do that. So once this heart turns, I think I've got the green light if I'm you. I love your bet size. I think, yeah.
Thanks. That was the next thing I was going to say. Why don't you tell me why it's so great?
I think you want to get some fold equity immediately, but I also think you want to be thinking about the river. So, again, there's 124 in the pot, and the stack to pot ratio is like 1.3 or 1.4. So I think betting like a third of the pot or a little bit more, that gives you, you know, it threatens stacks. It gives you plenty of fold equity immediately. And it's also big enough where it doesn't really look like you'll be doing a lot of hero folding if he jams on you. So I think you can get, you know, some of those ace nine, ace seven pocket queens if he... I'm not sure he has pocket queens, but, you know, king, jack, or whatever type hands. I think you can get some of those to fold, or just a float. People do float you sometimes, it turns out. So, not that this is a great board to float you with nothing, but, you know, if he had, he could have jack 10 of diamonds. Again, that's a double gutter with no flush draw, no backdoor flush draw. Decide he's getting a price on the flop, and then fold the turn. I think that happens a pretty good... I think that's really something you ought to consider.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, even like queen jack, I think, is not out of the question for him.
Oh, sure.
Queen jack of spades, especially.
Yeah. You know, once in a while, you know, he has another 10-8. I just, there's a lot of stuff he can have. Even like 10-9, 9-8, you know, we're getting less likely now, but I think the cumulative probability starts to suggest that you should really be trying to knock them off these hands. And so I think you should try to have fold equity on the turn, but not bet so much that you can't bluff the river. So I think, not that you should always bluff the river, but I think, you know,
it's nice to have the option.
Yeah, I think about a third of the pot is just a great size.
I think the really central question here is kind of, do I want to be split it like with my range in general, and the answer could even be both, but if I were only going to pick one of these two options, you know, do I want to be splitting the betting into two streets? Like, do I with my range overall, do I want to be betting turn small and giving myself the option of shoving the river, or would I rather just jam turn? And I think the answer is very much the latter. I think this is not a spot where, like, this is at this point, a big chunk of my range is pretty well locked in as nutted. I think, like, if I have a set, I don't really benefit that much from just like making a big, you know, over larger than pot jam on the turn. If I have a flush, I'm certainly not looking to do, like, I do want to put all the money in, but I don't think I really benefit from jamming it all in on the turn. The times when you're looking to overbet the turn is generally going to be in situations where the river card is very likely to be meaningful in some way, and you want to jam generally like some combination of big draws and like hands that are trying to push out hands with equity. And that's not really what's going on here. This is much more of a kind of either have it or you don't sort of spot on the turn in terms of, like, most of my range is either like really nutted or it's the rare bluff like this. And with the rare bluff like this, I mean, my bluffing ratio is not particularly high relative to my value ratio, my bluff to value ratio is not particularly high, so I don't think I need a large bet sizing in order to give my opponent a tricky decision. And I want room to fold if he jams. So I think that if he jams on this card, my equity is not going to be very good. I imagine his jamming range will consist mostly of like flushes, two pair plus, and maybe like ace king with the ace of hearts. Not that that's really a good hand to jam, but I think some people will jam it. But I think because some chunk of his jamming range has me drawing dead, I definitely don't want to just be jamming here on the turn and getting called by flushes. I think that by betting 45K, I'm in pretty good shape against his calling range. Like, I think at least six of my outs are live against his calling range a lot, but against his jamming range, I'm not in such good shape. So giving myself room to do that is nice also.
Yep.
He calls the 45K with a good deal of consideration. It was almost like, I'm never sure what to do in these spots when people seem on the turn like very genuinely distressed about whether or not they should call, but then they do call. I'm kind of like, well, if you're going to make it that obvious that you're not happy, like, sort of seems like you should just be folding now. And then I'm like, so does that mean it was just an act? Like, that you're like, I'm always sort of suspicious that people are like up to something when they make it so obvious that they're like torn about their decision and then just call in a spot where they're unlikely to get more information on the next street. Like, you know, if he has like ace king of clubs here, the river is not going to clarify his decision very often. So it's like, if you're going to make so clear that you're tormented by the spot now, I mean, you're just like inviting me to jam on you on the river, which almost makes me wonder if it's like something people are doing on purpose.
Yeah, I like that a lot, and I get very confused too, because I mean, like, really, after showing that much weakness, are they going to just decide that you're not bluffing on the river? It's just very strange. I always worry that they're in Macbeth mode, or what I think of right. as Macbeth mode when they do that.
That's the death protest too much.
No. For mine own good, all causes shall give way. I am in blood stepped in so far that, should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as gore. So the idea is that your opponent is, yeah, you get it. I mean, like, really, is he going to, like, turn around and go back and save his last money now? Very strange. It's really odd. And I don't know what to do. But then the river comes.
Yeah, he calls the 45K. We see the river with 214K in the pot, 120K in my stack. Now, I mentioned that he covered me. He didn't cover me by a tremendous amount. I would say he definitely has less than 200K in his stack now. He maybe has like 160. So he's going to be in pretty bad shape if he loses this pot. I mean, he still has a decent chance of cashing, but he'll be left with like six or seven big blinds. So it's going to be painful to him if he calls the shove and loses. River is the queen of clubs, which is nice. We talked a little bit about the possibility of the villain having jack 10 of clubs on the turn. I would sort of expect that would fold the turn just because of the risk of drawing dead to a flush, but not entirely impossible that he just decided to get really stubborn with that. It was not very consistent with his hemming and hawing.
That's the thing. If he did that, he would not be like... You can usually tell when people are deliberating about pot odds and when people are deliberating about whether or not they're drawing dead. Very different kinds of uncertainty. This Queen of Clubs is such a good card for you. So the board, that's again, the thing, yeah. King of Spades, Nine of Hearts, Seven of Hearts. Andrew has 10-8 of Clubs. Turn comes the Four of Hearts. River comes the Queen of Clubs. So what hands are kind of like 10-8 of Clubs? Well, 9-7 of Clubs is one of them. That's two pair. Jack 10 Jack 10 suited, that got there. Would you keep bluffing that on the turn? At least sometimes you kept bluffing with this straight draw, with this 8-out straight draw. Like, I mean, this is something that's really useful to me. It's like, if I'm asking, would I have done this with a hand? Like, you can just look at the hand you have. That's a pretty good guy. Like, if I have the exact same hand type as the hand that got there, that's pretty good. So you have all those flushes, very plausible, and all these hands that are almost exactly like the one you have got there, and he showed all that uncertainty on the turn. I mean, you're definitely going to be in the parking lot sometimes if you put your money in, but I think this would be a criminally bad no bluff. I think you absolutely have to bluff on this card.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. This is a well above average turn card. My plan really was to jam. I thought Heart Rivers were probably bad ones to jam, although that... in retrospect, that might be wrong. I kind of think that, like, he probably wouldn't be hemming and hawing like that if he had king with a heart. I think he would just relatively happily call. So in retrospect, hearts might not actually be so bad. I think without that, the act, I think a heart is a much less good river to shove, because I think, you know, he gets to the river with a fair number. I mean, especially since the king is not a heart, like there's a fair amount of king X with one heart kinds of hands that he can have. So I probably would not jam a fourth heart on the river. But I think, like, non-hearts, non-kings, nines and sevens, nines hurt and sevens a little bit.
Bad, yeah,
yeah. I think I might jam them anyway, though. Like, I would still jam a flush on a nine or a seven. So, I mean, I get to have a bit of a bluffing range. I still have, I mean, it takes out some of my sets. You know, obviously, if he boats up, he's not going anywhere. But I don't think, again, like the hemming and hawing on the turn seems a little less likely if he has a set than if he has like ace king. I think I did, and I'm getting such a good price on the bluff. I mean, yeah, it's the bubble and it kind of sucks the bubble, but like I'm risking 120 to win 214, so I don't need him to fold that much, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get a fold at least half the time, and even with ICM considerations, you gotta stick your money in. Yeah. You gotta stick your money in. You're getting a big return on your money. It's yeah. So what happens, Andrew? You shove your 120 into 214. What happens?
Yeah, I jam, and he, you know, again, like hems and hawls for a long time, which he really just needs to make up his decision on the turn about what he's going to do on the river. And so yeah,
this
why
guy is not like, that good. Like, I shouldn't say that. Maybe he's listening. I'm sure.
Yeah,
he's
I mean, the, like, sure this is a worse than average river. Like maybe he was planning on calling the deuce of clubs, and then this this one is just particularly bad. I mean, I don't know how relevant it is that he's losing to king queen. Realistically, I wouldn't play king queen this way, but you know, maybe he's considering that as well. But you know, he tanked forever. He folded a black ace king face up, and I you know, pretty rare that I show my cards. Particularly, I remember there's a passage from Elements of Poker where Tommy says even most people who claim that they're like showing their cards for some sort of strategic reason are mostly either just trying to like brag or get people to feel sorry for them. Yeah. And this was definitely like you know, my urge here was to brag and not to, you know, needle or whatever, or to, you know, get some strategic benefit from it. So I was like resisting the urge to show, and then he asked me to show, and I could not turn the cards. Like, if you want to see them, yeah, certainly, here you go.
Yeah. I actually think it's pretty okay in this spot, because like it's a little bit bad that they know you're capable of that, but more likely it's just going to make them fear you, and that's like absolutely just totally fear you.
Yeah, I think so. So yeah, that was a nice one to win there on the bubble.
Very nice.
Put me in good shape going into the final table bubble and then the final table.
Very nice hand.
Yeah. Our next strategy hand is coming from Butch, and this hand actually was also played at Maryland Live. This is a 1-2 no limit game. Butch describes himself, "I'm a mid-40s white male, overweight, graying goateed, blue tinted eyeglasses, and I wear a fedora. I'd like to think I'm not too nitty, but I do usually like to keep the premium starting hands and can't bring myself to 3-bet light most of the time. I can make a squeeze and recognize a good bluffing spot. It's my belief that my image should be more nitty than I actually play. I've loosened up my starting requirements and upped my aggression because we are currently playing 7-handed. And even just on that point, I think there's a common misconception about how to adapt to a shorthanded, and sorry, this is 6-handed, but how to adapt to a shorthanded table. So the reason that you're playing more hands at a shorthanded table is that you're never, you never have 8 or 7 or 6 people to act behind you. And so the spots at a full ring table where you play the fewest hands, under the gun one, under the gun two, at a 9-handed table, those seats don't exist at a 6-handed table. There's not a reason why, if everyone folds to you on the cutoff, you should really be opening any more hands at a 9-handed or at a 6-handed table than you would at a 9-handed table. You're essentially in the same situation at that point, that you have 3 players to act behind you. Like the really relevant thing, if there's no antes in the pot, the really relevant thing is just how many players are there still to act behind me. And that's true. I mean, the number of players who folded in front of you is a relatively trivial consideration. So although it's technically true that like your VPIP and your preflop raise will be higher, it's not higher in any given seat. It's just that the average is higher because you're pulling out a couple of the seats where you play the fewest hands. So I think if you're already properly adjusting your starting ranges by position, which, you know, maybe based on his self-description of, you know, I mostly play premium hands, it's possible that Butch is not fully doing that. But I think if you're already properly adapting to your position, you don't really need to further adapt to a 6-handed table. You just need to recognize that you're going to be playing the cutoff and the button and the blinds a lot more often, and will end up playing more hands for that reason.
I agree.
So Butch in this hand is big blind, and villain is under the gun one, which would also be low jack at a 6-handed table. Under the gun folds, villain bets $15. This is a 1-2 table, and Butch comments, this I think is a large open. However, it's hard to tell as villain is new to me. Both the cutoff and the button call, the small blind folds, and I find queen six of hearts in the big blind. I cannot fold here, though having to act first on the flop, I cannot see raising it either, so I call. What do you think, Nate? Can you fold here?
I think you can fold here. I think, shorthanded or not, this is a hand that does not play... I mean, the suitedness plays better, given that the hand is multi-way, but for such a large open, you don't want to be playing this out of position. You don't even have the nut flush draw. Queen six is just not a good hand. And I think sometimes there's another misconception that, like, the number of players is more important than the pot odds when you're trying to figure out whether to play a hand. And here the opening raise was so much that, especially after rake, you have to put something like 25% of the money into the pot before the flop, and you're out of position. And this hand will not win 25% of the money after the flop. So I would fold.
Yeah, I think the mistake a lot of people make is they say, well, you know, my odds are better because more people called. And that's technically true. Your odds are better than they would be if you were just heads up with the original raiser. But you have to remember that those additional people also have a chance of winning the pot. So, you know, you win the pot less often when there are three people. You're contesting it against three opponents rather than contesting it against one. So, you know, you need to be getting better pot odds if you're calling in a multi-way pot. So the simple fact that you're getting better pot odds doesn't mean that you can just, you know, never fold anything or never fold anything suited. And as you said, Nate, particularly in a 1-2 game, the rake is quite significant. And if you can think of it as, if you're contributing 25% of the pot, you need to have as good of a chance of winning as anyone else. Do you? No. You have a starting hand that is on average worse than anyone else's starting hand, and you have the worst position. So, you know, you do not have as good of a chance as winning as anyone else, and then that's probably why you should fold.
Yeah. I mean, it's so if you're in the small blind and three people limp, then you're getting immediately, you know, ignoring the rake this time, something like 9-1. That's just really, really different from 3-1. So, yeah, I would fold here every time. I hope.
Butch calls. The flop is, so Butch again holding queen six of hearts. The flop is queen 7-9 rainbow with one heart. Butch did not recall which, whether it was the seven or the nine that was the heart. I don't think it's terribly relevant. $55 in the pot. Butch says, I check. I'm almost always checking here. Is that bad? There are three people behind me, and I have top pair bad kicker. I'm thinking check call if the price and action seem promising. On this board, I'm playing most all of my mediocre holdings this way and probably betting two pair in sets. So I certainly think you should be, as you said, you know, mostly checking and calling. You do have to do a bit of evaluation. If the action goes like bet, call, call, you probably want to just fold. Even if it goes bet, call, you might even want to fold. But certainly if it ends up being heads up, I think you have a solidly calling hand. I don't think you benefit very much from betting, and certainly not from check raising. The only thing I really object to is the idea that you should be betting out with two pair of sets. I think this is probably a spot where you just want to check 100% of your range and be looking to check raise those stronger hands. And yeah, every once in a while it checks through, and that's a little bit bad for you, but I think most of the time we're going to see a bet from someone behind us, and so I think it's pretty safe to be, you know, trying to go for a check raise with your bigger hands. And, you know, of course it gives away less information than just only checking mediocre hands and always betting strong ones.
Yep.
So we check to the preflop raiser. The villain bets 20 into 55, and Butch says, I think this is small. Nonetheless, cutoff and button both fold. I'm definitely calling here. Still can't raise. His small bet could be a c-bet with ace-king or tens, or he could have ace-queen. Here's where I go off the rails. I integrate the action so far and arrive at the conclusion that he has a strong queen. It's ace-queen suited. Large preflop raise makes sense with ace-queen suited. The smaller c-bet, he's fishing for a raise that he would then 3-bet. I've totally figured him out. I decided to put him on a one-pair hand. Might not actually be ace-queen, but if I make a hand to beat top pair, top kicker, then I am hell-bent for glory. So I call $20 with $75 in the pot. Thoughts?
I like that he's trying to hand read here. That's good. And I like that he's, you know, conditioning his plan on the read that he gets. That said, I think the read is wrong and the plan is wrong given the read. So that's the bad side. I think sometimes trusting your gut is a good thing to do, right? And I, you know, at the beginning, our correspondent says his small c-bet could be a c-bet with ace-king or tens, or he could have ace-queen. And I think that's pretty good. he could have a lot of other stuff too. He could also just I think the small bet is likely to be just a sort of obligatory C bet. Like, he could have a good hand, but he could also have a hand that he feels obligated to throw some money into the pot with. So a hand like tens or ace jack or ace king or pocket fours. It could totally happen. I think I like our correspondent's first thoughts better than his second thoughts. Although I like that he has second thoughts too. He's like keeping on thinking.
He even kind of identifies, like, I mean, he says, this is where I went off the rails, and he's right. Like, he had the right read, and then he just decided to get more specific than was warranted.
Yeah, and boy, let me know, boy, this is, do I know a lot? I can really empathize just with a lot of precision right now. Like, I really know what this feels like. I've done it a lot. Just all the time. So, but I do think it's a mistake sometimes, like here. And I do think if you decide he has ace queen suited, then I would just fold, because he's probably, like, unless you can find a way to bluff him out on a lot of future streets, you're not getting your price to fish for your three outer. You have a really bad hand against ace queen. I think if you're going to make that great read, the thing to do, if you trust it, is just to fold right away. Or now, to try to bluff later, but really just
fold right away.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think, you know, what he ends up doing is calling with the plan of, and I mean, part of the issue is he's really only got half of a plan, or maybe he only gave us half of a plan because he does actually improve his hand. But, you know, he kind of talks about, here's what I'm going to do if I improve my hand. And you do also need to have in mind, you know, what are you going to do if you don't improve your hand? Yeah. And I think the play is probably to fold most turns if we're facing a second barrel. You know, there are some hands that could double barrel here, but I think given that we're already expecting this player to have a relatively strong hand from the fact that he made a large preflop raise and that he continuation bet into three people, I think that if we're facing a second bet on a card that doesn't improve your hand, and keeping in mind that, like, a heart improves your hand, so it's not like there's a fair number of turns you can continue on, but we're kind of drawing either to improve our hand or to a check, and if neither of those things happens, then I think the plan ought to be just to fold to a turn bet. Does that sound right to you, Nate?
Yeah, I think it does. And I should say, our correspondent, what he actually does is checks and calls $20, probably planning on folding to a lot of further action and not folding if he improves. So this is a little bit like Paul O'Neill going on tilt and kicking the ball to first base, and it works. Probably a reference you don't know. Very famous baseball play, though. So, I mean, it works out. He's doing the right thing here. Just the reasoning is a little bit out of whack. So that's okay.
Yeah, and the second half of the plan, though, you know, what's going to happen if you improve to the point where you can beat top pair, top kicker? I mean, again, that's spot on. Like, yeah, if you have two pair or better and the stack to pot ratio is like two, then yes, you should be looking to get all of the money in. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens. So the turn is a six. He forgets the suit, but presumably it wasn't the six of hearts. Well, yeah, that's in his hand, so probably not the six of hearts. Turn is a six. $95 in the pot. I have queens up. I'm beating all one pair hands. And let's keep in mind the effective stacks as well. I believe we are starting with $300. Maybe you didn't. Yeah, I think maybe I didn't read that part, but I believe we're starting with $300 stacks in this hand. So at this point, we're looking at a stack to pot ratio of like 2.5, somewhere in that neighborhood. Which I think with, you know, any hand that can beat an overpair or ace queen, we should definitely be looking to put all of the money in. He says, now what do I bet? This is bad, but I bet $35. I don't know why. I wanted him to call. Didn't want to miss a bet, so I had to lead. And his last bet was a weak $20. I think I should have left when my previous table was breaking. I like this sort of like stream of conscious. Looking back at it, I should have bet at least $50 or let him keep the initiative.
Oh, bad. Is this actually me? Is this a hand that I wrote in with like a year ago? I feel like this could be me. Like, that's, I feel an incredible sense of community with this person.
I agree with this conclusion. I think this is a reasonable card to have a donk betting range on. I mean, it's one that the villain, especially some more timid villains, might be a little reluctant to follow through on because the board now is queen 9-7-6. So there's a lot of like a lot of ways you could have two pair besides this one. Some ways you could have just made a straight. I think this is a card that the villain probably ought to be just getting it in with like aces and kings and ace queen, but many people are going to be overly timid about putting their stacks in. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of villains will check back those kinds of hands. So donk betting is not unreasonable here, but if you're going to do it, I think Butch is absolutely right. You want to make a larger bet. And really, we need to be, again, thinking in terms of how can we put stacks in there? How can we make a bet? Because although I don't think the opponent is going to be very willing to, I think there's a fair chance the opponent might not bet the turn with like aces or kings or ace queen. I can also tell you the opponent is not going to fold for like a $70 bet on the turn if he has aces or kings. He's not just going to muck those. So you know, thinking in terms of a value target, sticking with the read that there's a decent chance the villain has a strong pair and we can now beat a strong pair, we ought to be betting big and trying to set up a river shove. And failing that, yeah, I think checking and just giving him a chance to bet again and then looking to check raise is the alternative.
Yeah, I think I might check here in the first place, though, and here's why. You know, putting myself in our correspondent's shoes, which, again, I find very easy to do. If he actually has ace queen here, like if what I'm thinking is, oh, I like my spidey sense is going off, I think he has a good hand this time, but maybe I'm wrong and he has nothing because the bet is weak, then that's a range that I think I want to check against. Like, I'm not sure a lot of 1-2 players are going to check behind with aces or ace queen or a hand like that. And if they have stone nothing, yeah, maybe they picked up some sort of draw that I would like to bet at, but on balance, I would rather give them a chance to bluff again. So I think I would probably check here. Is that bad?
Like I said, I mean, it really just comes down to how confident you are that the villain will bet again with aces or kings or ace queen. I think the average 1-2 player is overly loose and overly passive and overly timid about getting stacked. And I would not at all be shocked to see someone decide he's supposed to check behind here for pot control or whatever because he didn't want to get check raised. And I don't think that player is ever folding aces or kings or ace queen to a turn bet. So, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of downside. I also don't think we're going to see a lot of double barreling here. Like, I don't think ace king is betting again. You know, maybe tens and jacks do, but...
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't think there's a lot of downside to just betting.
Yeah, that seems right. And the pre-flop raise size makes it harder for him to have stone nothing that will bet again.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I like that.
So Butch actually bets $35. The villain raises to $100. Ugh. I tanked a bit, but eventually convinced myself he could do this with top pair, top kicker, and then my $35 actually invited a raise. So in keeping with my intuition from the flop, I still think I'm likely ahead with queens up. I re-raise all in. And I agree that, you know, given everything I just said about the average 1-2 player being overly passive and reluctant to get stacked, I don't feel great about his willingness to raise here, which is why I would just rather be putting the money in myself rather than giving him the option of, you know, only putting the money in when he wants. Like, if he's not going to raise hands like aces and kings and ace queen here, that's all the more reason why you ought to be betting more, because he will call with those hands. But yeah, I think this is just too much hand to be doing anything other than sticking it in with. I would need a pretty good read to justify folding this. I mean, among other things, we're blocking some of the hands we might be most worried about. And, you know, this would not be the first 1-2 player in history to overvalue an overpair.
Yep.
Results, as we might guess, Butch ended up losing to Queen 9. So I think that's a pretty significant cooler element, although, you know, this is part, like, I think Queen 9 is not really strong enough hand for the villain to be opening. I mean, villain just shouldn't have a $15 opening range. I don't mean to suggest that, like, he should be making larger raises with strong hands and smaller with weak ones. But if for some reason he's playing a strategy that involves making $15 open raises, Queen 9 suited probably should not be in that range. That said, you know, there is a reason why Queen 6 gets folded pre-flop, and it's that it's an easily dominated hand, so it's not entirely bad luck, although there's a heavy element of bad luck that you ended up in this sort of situation, but mostly just a cooler, and I think you identified a lot of your own errors in thinking. Hopefully we've identified a few more for you, and you ended up making a lot of the right decisions despite the errors in thinking. So I think there's a lot to be proud of here, not least of which is listening to and writing to the Thinking Poker podcast. Anything you want to add, Nate?
Yeah, I think you did really well. I think probably working on the mental game is good. Like, seems like a perfectly well-adjusted person, but in this hand, I think he would be, and in fact was, the first to say that his thinking got off the rails a little bit. And
I cut out some introductory information from this email. This hand took place at like 4 a.m. after, like, you know, one table had broken, and then he got moved to another table, and I think a lot of thinking starts to break down at 4 a.m. in the poker room.
The tables aren't the only things that are breaking. So. Yeah, so you know, eat right, exercise a little bit before before you play, a little bit of meditating. That might help more than even listening to strategy segments, although certainly keep listening to the strategy segments. And thank you for writing to podcast@thinkingpoker.net.
All right, let's squeeze in this last strategy question.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's an 08, a spread limit 08 question.
Oh, man.
If you needed any additional incentive.
Be still, my beating heart.
This is coming from Austin Bluffs. Austin says, a few months ago, I read Easy Game by Andrew Seidman, a former Thinking Poker podcast guest, Beluga Whale. One topic that I've always pondered from that book is the reasons for betting. In the third edition of the book, Seidman mentions that the reasons are value, trying to get called from a worse hand, bluffing, trying to make a better hand fold. And then he discusses the controversial reason that he supported in earlier editions of the book, but no longer supports as a primary reason for betting, but rather as a consequence of betting for value or as a bluff, is to capitalize on dead money, meaning to deny a player their equity share in a hand. So this is commonly thought of as protection. So this is sort of just a theory question about how to value, to what extent betting for protection is a thing. If we kind of think of, you know, betting for value as betting and getting called by worse, bluffing is betting and making better hands fold, betting for protection is sort of like betting and causing worse hands that still have equity to fold. That's sort of the third reason. And I mean, my own thinking on this is ultimately it's just kind of a continuum. And If we insist on calling bluffing, you know, only making better hands fold, then we have to create some third category for protection. But ultimately, like, the expected value of any bet, if we set aside the possibility of getting raised for a second, the expected value of a bet is your expected value when called, plus your fold equity, you know, the percentage equity in the pot that the opponent folds away, multiplied by the size of the pot. So most hands, most bets are benefiting from both of these things to some degree. When you 3-bet ace-king pre-flop, we generally think of that as a value 3-bet, and often, you know, hands that ace-king is ahead of, including hands that it dominates, we'll call the 3-bet. But if you 3-bet ace-king and cause an opponent to fold 10-8 suited, there's a lot of value in that, especially if that player is going to check-raise and barrel you out later.
Very nice.
So... So, you know, even though it's a value 3-bet, like, the value is coming not only from getting called by worse, but also from making hands that might have 25 or 30% equity in the pot fold. And this is true even when you have pocket aces, you know, pushing somebody off of like 10-8 suited is part of the value of raising pocket aces, even though it's not the primary source of value. So some bets get more of their value from fold equity, some get more from the times when they're called. But I think most bets are getting a combination of the two things, and I think the most profitable bets tend to benefit from both.
Yeah, I think getting into long arguments about this, like, can be instructive, but often is not. I also think that if you don't think that protecting your hand is a thing, then, like, you haven't played a lot of limit poker. Like, this just happens all day, every day in a limit poker table. Like, you bet the turn and gut shots have to fold, and you probably have a really good hand. I mean, this just happens all the time. And I think when you're in that limit mentality, like, do hands with getting their price ever fold? In a lot of spots, no. are you getting value from some hands? Like, yeah, you are getting value from some hands. Like, what's going to happen a lot? King high folds, and that's better than letting it see a free river. You know, a gut shot folds, that's better than letting it see a free river. That just happens all day, every day, and I think it's a useful way to think. So, I don't know. I would not agree with Beluga Whale here that's not a thing. But
yeah, I, in his defense, I don't think he's really saying it's not a thing. And I do tend to think people tend to worry, think about it in the wrong way. So I also kind of encourage people to think about their bets first and foremost as, you know, either having a value target or a bluff target. And the in no limit anyway, I do tend to think that protection is often a secondary effect. It's often an important secondary effect, but I do think it tends to be a secondary effect. And there's a lot of players go wrong when they start worrying too much about protecting their hands.
Yep. Limit players especially.
So the hand that Austin wanted to ask us about is from a 2-5-0-8 game. He calls this Colorado limit. So it's a $100 max bet, because I think that's the law in Colorado, or was when he played this hand anyway. We're nine-handed, average stack about $250, average age about 60. One player was the exception. He was probably in his 20s, loose, aggressive, arrogant, recently sat down with $2,500 in a few orbits.
Oh, man. It's, you know, one thing, I agree, I've made some mistakes in my life, and I would have more money now if I'd focused more on No Limit in the early days, but all these hours I've gotten to spend watching arrogant 25-year-olds like yell at tables full of 60-year-old men like playing 08, like as they're getting eight hands an hour. It's yeah, it's a thing. It's really a thing. Anyway, go ahead.
In a few orbits, I saw that this player would almost always raise his button. Other players tended to limp to the flop. He was in seat three on the button, and I was at the other end of the table in seat eight. I was dealt ace ace deuce nine. Don't remember whether I was suited. And I had about $250. Knowing that I was well ahead of his range, out of position, and that he would likely raise his button, I limped with the intention to 3-bet any raise. With a couple of limpers, the villain raised to $40, as I expected. It folded around to me, and I raised to $140. Everyone folded, and I took a pot of about $55 after the $5 rake. As the villain mucks, he asked me arrogantly, "Do people really pay you off in that spot?" Which appeared to mean that he thought I should bet a strong hand with a size that would be called. I dismissed his comment and continued to play my game. In reflecting on that hand, I further pondered Andrew Seidman's writings. It seems to me that looking for a fold with a better hand as a primary reason for betting while out of position in Omaha 8, where I understand equities run close, would be a reasonable play. The situation I wanted to avoid was seeing a flop with no possibility or a low draw with no counterfeit protection and no high hand but a pair of aces on a wet board. Can you tell me your general thoughts about hand protection and denying another player their equity share of a pot? In this situation, do you think raising in the first place, limp calling, or making a smaller limp re-raise has more merit?
What a great question. We've already discussed the general question. Can I talk a little bit about spread limit?
Yes, you are our expert.
Yeah, it's possible. I'm not really keeping up with this, but I think it's at least like 50-50 that I've still written the most famous poker strategy article ever on spread limit poker. So I feel like an authority here. So yeah, $100 max bet. It's like limit, but so if the pot gets big, it's like straight limit. You know, not even limit where the bet doubles on the turn, like straight limit. So if you can get money in the pot early with a good hand, you are awesome. Like, what's he going to do? Bet an eighth of the pot on the river? Like, ooh. Like, who cares? Like, it's the pot's really big. Yeah, you wouldn't like to see a bad flop, but deal with that later. I would probably not have a raising range from early position. Then when I limped, I would limp fold, limp call, limp re-raise. Sometimes you have a tremendous
hand. Sorry, quickly, Nate. Is that specifically because this player is raising too much on the button, or is that just general? You would not have a limping range or a raising range in early position.
Yeah, things run together so much in 08 that I would probably just, I think, from a theory point of view, I'd like to just be limping. And also, exploitively, in like every Omaha game I've ever played, almost, like, they'll just limp behind way too much, and you lose a lot of your high hand value if it goes six ways to the flop, but not all of it, and you still have an ace deuce, so that's fine. And then sometimes it goes like limp, 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 raise, and you can re-raise, things are happy. Just a lot of good stuff happens if you limp. And then if you make it 20 and four people call, then you still lose a lot of your high card value. Yeah, the stack size gets a little bit awkward. So like, good things happen if you play deep and don't invest a lot of money. Good things also happen if you float the pot so big before the flop that you get a lot of money immediately because your hand is so good, and you don't really have to worry too much about bad implied odds because the future bets are going to be so small. So I think limber raising in this game structure is very good. And if somebody else is raising too much on the button, that's fantastic. And his little snide comment to you shows that he has no idea what he's talking about. So that's good. So I like the raise. And like, why are you raising? Well, he could call with worse. That's good. He could fold hands that have some equity against you. Yeah, that's very possible, especially if he plays okay later. But mostly, I would like to have a limp re-raising range, and I would like this hand to be in it. That's really my biggest issue, I think, with some of these hand categories, is that they're not range sensitive enough, and that they encourage you to think a little bit too narrowly and a little bit too in a vacuum about your hand, and they really open you up to getting hand read if you don't think about your range. So my biggest reason here is that, you know, not only do I have a great hand, but I would like to have a limp re-raising range, and ace deuce nine, fine hand to do it with.
So the one question, I guess, is even if we're going to limp re-raise, given that this is such a nutty kind of hand, should he be re-raising somewhat less than the maximum?
No.
All right, thanks for writing.
No, I think if you do that, then a lot of hands will do okay against you. Like, if you had like the nine is a pretty hard dangler there, unless it's suited. So, like, in a vacuum, if you had like ace king deuce, then maybe you would really love to trap people. But like, what are you gonna do, make it 80 more? Then all of a sudden it's looking like people flop a lot of equity in Omaha, and again, to remind our listeners, we started the hand with only 250. So if it goes like 40 to 110, then the other person would be calling 70. Then the stack to pot ratio would be less than one on the flop, and your opponent really will have some equity sometimes. Like, will fold sometimes correctly. Like, you'll shut them out of equity sometimes. That'll be nice, but that's not like a stack to pot ratio that really favors you with this hand. And the way you flop equity, you would rather pump up the pot before the flop, given the stacks, given your hand, etc.
I would guess if there's any mistake that our correspondent is making in this spot, it might be that there are maybe some other hands that he should be limp re-raising besides, you know, ace deuce x, in order to take advantage of it. So, I mean, it could be that this player is kind of correctly hand reading him and saying, well, you obviously have a huge hand when you limp re-raise. Are there other hands that you think our correspondent could defensively play this way that might not be so obvious?
I mean, if the button is raising a lot, like if you have ace jack 7-3 suited to the 7, ship it. Like, put it, like what's he gonna do? Like, he probably has a bad hand. If he doesn't have a bad hand, you have a lot of equity. Do you really want to play that hand? Like, what's he gonna do, like call you? So the same thing I said also applies. Like, are you gonna flop no equity with ace jack 7-3? Well, sometimes, but it'll be obvious, then you'll check fold. And then other times you'll flop a pair in a crappy low draw, or a pair in a good low draw but not a great low draw, or you'll flop two pair and there'll be no low on board, and you'll just ship it in, and he'll either say something stupid and call, or say something stupid and fold, and either way you're usually fine against his range. So yeah, I think with this stack size, again, very important, $250 in the stack to start effectively, very important. If your opponent is raising too much and trying to, like, quote unquote, like, put you to the test or whatever with his like 8-8-5-4, then yeah, shove it in his face with a lot of hands. Like, you know, I would say probably don't leave home without an ace, as the old Helmuthian advice goes. but yeah, if you do have a pretty good hand, I would, like, once he makes it 40, they're probably, and this is exploitive, but if he really is raising most of his buttons, there aren't a lot of hands I would call the 40 with. In fact, I don't think there are any hands I would call the 40 with. Like, if I have a hand I like that much, I would just punish him for raising and right, make it 140.
Yeah, and then if you have a truly bad hand, you can just fold.
Yes, and I probably would have folded in the first place. Like, that's the really good play, right? Is if he's raising a lot of buttons, and if you're going to fold to a raise, then maybe you should just save your $5. That's a lot.
Right.
It's, you know, what, 2 gallons of gas? That's a lot of money.
Yeah, well played here. If anything, there's probably even more ways that you could be taking advantage of this player, but no, you should not allow his... I mean, I guess it's fine to question your own play, but, you know, in most scenarios, those loudmouth players do not really know what they're talking about. The best poker players I can think of one or two exceptions, but it's quite rare to see someone who's truly good at poker berating someone at the table. Like, the loudmouths don't usually know nearly as much as they think they do.
That's right. And very important, if you're playing 2-5 spread limit 08, please send us hands. I love this stuff. Please. podcast@thinkingpoker.net. podcast@thinkingpoker.net. We're going to grow the game, and then all that money will eventually flow to Angela Jordison, and then she'll come back on the podcast. It'll be great.
All right. Awesome.